presiding, your silence is commanded.
Must have forgotten something. Glasses?
Very important.
Like, where'd she go? Right. She was just... The lights are off.
Okay. All right, please be seated.
Good morning. This morning, we have, for a first case, 22AP78, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Incorporated versus the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Could we start with your appearances? Morning. All right, good morning. The lineup that I have, just to make sure we're all on the same page, 25 minutes, followed by 15 minutes and 15 minutes, and then back for 5 minutes in rebuttal, correct? All right, very good. With that, please proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please, for nearly 50 years, DNR and tens of thousands of Wisconsinites have successfully used the spill law to protect our environment and public health against discharges of harmful contaminants. The spill law has worked so well for decades precisely because the legislature broadly defined the hazardous substances that dischargers must report and clean up, namely those that, quote, may pose a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment. This case involves an ordinary application of that standard. Leatherich wanted a valuable spill law liability exemption, so it investigated its property, discovered PFAS, among other things, and reported this to DNR. DNR then asked Leatherich to address this discharge, which undisputedly poses a public health hazard. Yet respondents insist that DNR must ignore this harmful PFAS discharge, and indeed many other kinds of harmful discharges, because no administrative rule lists all hazardous substances covered by the spills law. Respondents' position would fundamentally rewrite the spills law and cause two serious consequences that I just want to address right. First, it would greatly hamstring DNR's ability to protect public health and the environment. Harmful spills like Leatherich's would not just vanish. Instead, they would remain in the environment unless and until DNR can promulgate rules, something that would very likely require further legislative action, which is a point I want to return to later. Second, respondents' position would seriously weaken the entire executive branch's core power to interpret and execute the law. Virtually all statutes require interpretation before agencies can administer them. If agencies cannot administer laws like this one without rulemaking, executive branch activity would grind to a halt.
Counsel, your principal brief doesn't address Section 227.10 of the Wisconsin statutes, which says each agency shall promulgate, as a rule, each statement of general policy and each interpretation of a statute which it specifically adopts to govern its enforcement or administration of that statute. Doesn't that apply here?
So I think it's important to read that provision in context with the more recent guidance document definitions that the legislature added to the statutes, because I think when you contrast those two statutes, to me it becomes very clear that what's going on here is are simply explaining how it intends to apply the law, which, again, the statutes are very clear to constitute guidance documents. And I'd point you to start, two provisions. First, 227.03MA, which defines guidance documents in two, you know, very similar related ways, but I'll articulate both of them. Guidance documents, quote, explain the agency's implementation of a statute, and alternatively, guidance documents provide guidance or advice with respect to how the agency is likely to apply a statute it enforces. So that's statute one. Statute two is 227.05, which, to be sure, was invalidated in the SEIU case, but I think still provides helpful context in terms of what is a guidance document, what is a rule. So 227.05 required, past tense, agencies to identify support for, quote, any interpretation of law that the agency makes in guidance documents. And so I think those two provisions make clear that there are many, perhaps most occasions in which when the agency explains how it intends to interpret and apply a statute, it's creating a guidance document, and that is something that is not a rule. And I think another way to look at this is to examine Justice Kelly's writing in the SEIU case, where he's very clear, I believe this is paragraphs around 98 to 108, somewhere in that range. But in paragraph 106, Justice Kelly writes, guidance documents, quote, explain statutes or provide guidance or advice about how the executive is likely to apply them. They contain the executive's interpretation of the laws.
Then what's a rule?
Sorry?
Then what's a rule? Where do we draw the line between guidance and a rule? Because the legislature is supposed to enact the laws, the rules, if you will, that govern society. And that's the complaint here that is being made by the regulated community. We don't know what the government is going to do with this law. And perhaps we can point the finger at the legislature and say, stop drafting this very broad legislation and ceding your power to the executive branch to fill in all the details and to actually make the rules, even though the Constitution says that's supposed to be what the legislature is doing. But I'm struggling with your interpretation of these statutes to see the distinction between guidance and a rule, because the executive branch, I think you would agree, can't do something different, can't create law that the legislature hasn't sanctioned, if you will. So what's the difference in your mind between guidance and a new law in the guise of a rule?
Well, I think the primary difference, and this is a definitional one in a sense, is that rules themselves have independently the force of law, and guidance does not. And I think what that means in this context, and I think an example might be helpful. So consider the spill law and a DNR enforcement action thereunder. And we actually don't have to imagine a hypothetical here. We have the Johnson Controls case that's pending. And what you can see in that case is when DNR wants to enforce against a violation of the spill law, it doesn't say, for instance, Johnson Controls, you violated, you know, this statement that we posted on our website that says we think PFAS are hazardous substances. No, instead, DNR files a complaint that says, Johnson Controls, you violated 292.11 sub 3. You violated the statute itself. A rule violation would look very different. A rule violation would come in the form of DNR pleading, you know, a specific code provision that someone has violated, and they'd say, you can't do that. That code provision has the force of law, you can't violate it. But there's a fundamental distinction, again, here, when the agency simply interprets a statute and enforces its interpretation of that statute, what has the force of law is the statute itself, not the agency's interpretation. And, of course, that's tested in an enforcement action. If someone disagrees with the interpretation, it's obviously up to the judiciary to say who's right. And that, I think, is the fundamental reason why if there's any category of interpretations that constitute rules, and I'll talk more about that, it has to be a very, very narrow one. And I think what this court has recognized is only in the context of changes in interpretations do you really have a problem. What you can see is in really almost every single case that this court has considered on the unpromulgated rulemaking topic, you know, all the way back to Frankenthal and Berry Labs, the very old cases, never did this court say, and those are cases where they found an unpromulgated rule, but in none of those cases did the court go on to say, agency, you cannot act under the statute until you promulgate a rule that embodies your interpretation. That was never what the court said in those old cases. They said, well, there's an unpromulgated rule, but agency, you know, go back and do it again. Go back and make the same evaluation. And I'll give you an example. So I think one good case that I, in retrospect, regret not discussing more in a brief is Wisconsin Telephone versus Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations. That's at 68 Wis Second 345. And what was going on there is Diller was considering termination, I believe, and the allegation was that it was a sex discrimination because I believe the woman was pregnant, and Diller basically decided pregnancy status counts as a form of sex discrimination under the statute. And the question was presented to the court, what, is that a rule? Is that an unpromulgated rule? I believe there were guidelines that Diller had written down that said, you know, pregnancy status counts. And what the court said was, in this case, we view that as a rule that should have been promulgated, but what was the result? Not that the agency had to stop and not enforce the sex discrimination statute until rules had been promulgated, which would be the result, I think, if 227.10.1 were read as broadly as they say. Instead, the result was a remand to the agency. And so I'll just read you a couple excerpts that I think are really precisely respondent's position here that's rejected in Wisconsin Telephone. Again, there, the employer argues that if the guidelines are invalid, then the policy embedded in the guideline is also unenforceable, which I think would reflect the position that they're articulating, which is that if there's no rule, you basically can't enforce the statute at all. And what the court said, the court rejected that argument. It said, failure to file the guideline as a rule did not deprive the department of the authority to decide contested cases dealing with pregnancy leaves. Went on to say, it is within the agency's power to reach the same result under the applicable statute and remanded for further consideration. And that's really the pattern in most of these cases, virtually all of them. You know, the court may find an unpromulgated rule, but it'll remand to the agency to do it again. And again, the reason is, these interpretations, they don't have the force of law. Again, the agency cannot come in and say, my word is final. I think that's a fundamental misconception that we have here in the respondent's position.
I don't think they're saying that, though, counsel. And I'm going to interrupt you there because I want to explore this point with you. Mm-hmm. The argument from the regulated community is, here you have Leather Ridge. They were cooperative with DNR. They actually reported without being told to do so, right, the existence of the PFAS. So you don't have somebody who is trying to avoid the law. Their principal complaint, as I understand it, is they don't know what it is. And the government's counter is, well, you have to figure it out for yourself. But do you see how unsatisfying that is to the regulated community? Because they have to figure out what a vague, broadly written statute means when they have the government agency saying, it means this, you must do this. There's a threat of fines against them. So you're saying it doesn't have the force of law, but they're taking a huge risk, aren't they, counsel, if they don't follow the directives, which is how I read the letters and communications they received, whether it's posted on DNR's website or if it's a letter directly to an individual regulated party. And it feels like, you know, the goalpost is shifting. And I understand the argument over, you know, Lamar and other cases. Well, that's when there's been a change in the interpretation. But from the regulated community's perspective, it is a change because in the past those weren't regulated or restricted or deemed to be hazardous substances, and now they are. So the counter to your argument that, well, there hasn't been a change in interpretation, in other words, the agency hasn't flipped its position, is a bit unsatisfying because they have, in fact, changed their position. They're now saying PFAS are hazardous.
Well, I just want to start on that last point you made because I do think it's an important one. I think there has to be a fundamental difference between a case like Lamar, in which at one point the agency expressly tells the regulated community, we think the statute means X. And then at a later date, it reverses course and says, we think the statute means not X. I think that is that 180 degree shift in what the agency expressly tells the public is what was concerning to the court in Schoolway and Lamar. I think it has to be a fundamentally different situation when an agency for the first time is presented with a new set of facts. This happens all the time. I mean, the legislature crafts regulatory standards that are general. They can't conceivably apply or in the statute enumerate and articulate every single possible application of the statute. So this happens all the time. An agency has a general regulatory statute that sets out a standard And it's presented with new sets of facts. You know, does this new activity fall within the statutory standard? And that, I don't think, can be fairly characterized as a change. You know, the agency has never taken a position on this issue. It's never seen this issue because we acknowledge there's scientific progress incorporated into this. And so when the DNR first and the scientific community, you know, first began learning about PFAS, that's a new application of the statute for the first time. I think characterizing that as a change is just not accurate. And, you know, if it were the case that agencies, whenever they confront a new set of facts to which a statute should be applied, would have to promulgate a rule before it could confront that new factual scenario, which I do think is respondents' position here, that's a serious problem for the executive branch. I think, as this court recognized in SEIU and in Justice Kelly's opinion, that if the executive cannot interpret the law, understand what the law means, and then actually execute the law in accordance with that interpretation, you know, the executive branch can't do its job. I mean, that is the executive's most basic job. I do have a number of responses on the notice issue that I would like to get to, but no, please.
I want to, before you leave that point, I want to go back to 227.10 because there's no reference in that statute to a change in the agency's position. It says each agency shall promulgate whenever it specifically adopts an interpretation of a statute. So perhaps the cases have rewritten that statute, although I was part of the Lamar Court and that was not my intent, but we won't get into that. But do you think that the court has rewritten sub 1 to suggest that there has to be a change? Because that's nowhere in the text.
I wouldn't say it's rewritten sub 1. I think what this court has implicitly recognized...
You don't have the power to do that, though, right,
Gonzo? Of course. I think what the cases bear out, and again, I would point you to the guidance document definition, which I do think is very important. 227.10 sub 1 must mean something quite narrow. And that, I think, has to be... So it says specifically adopted to govern the enforcement of a statute. So I think right there we have an indication that it's some narrower subset of activity than simply thinking about what a statute means, telling the public, and then enforcing in that manner. It has to be a specific adoption that governs the administration of the statute. And you can see that in cases like Chalvin, for instance, in which the Department of Health Services, in administering a Medicaid benefits provision, had that I think turned on essentially how functional the individual was in terms of day-to-day activities. I think it was sort of like a... The statutory standard was very general. And what DHS did is it issued this booklet that basically said, we read this as one-third. If this individual is, like, incapacitated, don't quote me on the language, more than one-third of the days in a month, they qualify for this benefit under this general statutory standard. And so that independent standard that the agency had written down, and when making benefits determinations, it pointed to that to make the determination. That, I think, is what the court has seen as interpretations that may carry the effect of law. Again, an independent standard apart from the statute, which, again, is not what we have here. Every statement that you see in which that they point to, in which DNR says, conveys to the public, we think PFAS are hazardous, you should probably clean them up under the spills law, they immediately reference the statute. You know, they say 292.11 covers hazardous substances. Here's the definition, 292.01 sub 5. So it's very clear that when, in this case, DNR is explaining its view of what the spill law requires, it's pointing to the statute itself. It's just saying, here's the statute, here's how we read it. Regulated parties can disagree. They can say, we don't think it's hazardous, and we'll fight that out in an enforcement action if we have to. I think it's telling here. This is one of the reasons I have a hard time understanding this notice issue. Really, two reasons. One is that, you know, Leatherich knew it was subject to the spills law. Leatherich knew that it had potentially discharged hazardous substances. well before they had any contact with the department, they installed an impermeable barrier. So, I mean, they knew that there were chemicals being dumped. So it's not as if they were not on notice of this law. Two, they reported. Like you said, they voluntarily reported. And three, there, again, is no dispute here that the PFAS discharge is hazardous, actually satisfies the statutory criteria. So it's fairly difficult for me to understand how there's truly a notice issue when there's no argument that I've seen that this PFAS discharge actually doesn't fall within the statutory standard.
So, Attorney Roth, your time's ticking by really quickly. So I just want to ask you, I want to get your thoughts about this. Let's suppose the court would require the DNR to undertake rulemaking to designate substances as hazardous. Would the legislature be able to veto those rules?
Well, under the current scheme, yes. I mean, obviously in 2 days we have another argument that will call that into some question, but under the current scheme, that's correct.
So tell me what you think that would do for parties trying to comply in that level of uncertainty. Would that impact the...
Well, I think that's yes. I mean, it would negatively impact regulated parties, and I understand... Leatherich here says, well, it's a burden on us to have to clean up the PFAS, but I think you'll see the reason this all happened is because there was a property transaction. Leatherich wanted to sell the property, and in ordinary commercial transactions, the buyer doesn't want to buy contaminated property. And so, you know, if we accept this argument and essentially spills law enforcement comes to a halt until rulemaking is completed, it's not clear to me how that benefits the regulated community. I mean, if you just have these contaminants just sitting in the ground, someone's going to want them cleaned up one way or the other.
I just have maybe two quick questions. If I want to make sure I understand your argument, is your argument on the interpretation piece that what's going on here is not really interpretation of the statute but application of it? Or is your argument that it is interpretation but we need to somehow... interpretation narrowly?
I think the latter. I mean, it is an interpretation. I mean, it's you can have sort of abstract interpretations or applied to specific facts. It is an interpretation of the statute. What I would say is 227.10.1 needs to be interpreted narrowly, both as a matter of constitutional avoidance, because again, I think it's critical to credit the SEIU discussion of what it means to interpose sort of notice and comment procedures and potentially a veto between the executive branch and enforcement of the law. And narrowly interpreted again, you can accomplish that, I think, by focusing on the specifically adopted to govern it. Again, it's not all interpretations. It's there's a qualifier there.
Okay, great. And then my second question is, if this court agreed that these different policy statements or things on the website are guidance documents and not rules, does that answer everything with regard to that part of the case, or is there more that we would need to decide?
Well, I mean, their claim has evolved over time. Let's put it at that. Below, in the Court of Appeals, the primary argument was that these statements on the website and in the letters qualified as rules under 227.01.13. That was the almost sole focus, I think, of the Court of Appeals decision. And I think if this court was to say they're guidance documents, that argument would be resolved in DNR's favor. However, I think in this court, they've shifted quite dramatically, in my view, to the much more aggressive argument that doesn't just focus on the statements, but that 227.10.1 itself affirmatively requires rulemaking before the executive branch can enforce. That's a much more aggressive position. That is not the one on which the Court of Appeals decided the case. And I would note, I think this is very conspicuous. I encourage you to read the legislature's amicus brief. And I think the legislature's amicus brief. And I think it's very noteworthy that they do not adopt this very aggressive 227.10 sub 1 argument. And I think they very pointedly say, our argument primarily is that what DNR has done is invalid under 227.10.2m, which is the explicit authority standard. What they say is, and I disagree, you know, as you can see in our briefs, but what they say is, you know, this charts a middle course between the two parties, you know, sort of extreme positions is how they put it. But I think that's very telling, that the legislature itself comes in and very notably does not endorse youth. I think the legislature understands what this would mean is that if regulated parties, not just in the spill law context, but anywhere, could resist enforcement action or regulation, period, simply by saying, well, the agency must be interpreting the statute. It doesn't have a rule, so therefore the statute effectively is inert until rules are promulgated. I think the legislature understands that that is not a result that it wants. It wants its statutes to have force when it passes them, not for the effect of these statutes to essentially be conditioned on rulemaking activity by the executive branch.
But doesn't 227.10 sub 1 answer that argument as well, because it expressly says it doesn't apply to a statement of policy or an interpretation that is applied to a specific set of facts, and the distinction here is that this isn't something that's just applying to Leather Ridge. It's a statement of policy that DNR is adopting that these substances are hazardous, and then these steps need to be taken to remediate.
Well, I have two responses. One is that Lamar, as I read it, essentially read that second sentence, I mean, out of the statute. There's not much room left for the second sentence under Lamar. I mean, Lamar essentially says if the agency, and again, this is a change case. I think it's critical to remember it's a change case. I see my light is on. Can I finish the answer?
You may finish the answer, but I'm also going to give Justice Kroski the chance to ask the questions she tried to do at the same time Justice Protasiewicz was asking her questions, which was then followed by Justice Hagedorn and now Justice Bradley. So we're going to go backwards a little bit.
And the beginning was the word.
Thanks, Chief.
Genesis 1-1. Where was I?
Lamar.
Right, well, right.
Lamar so, reading something out right. of the statute that the court didn't have the power
Well,
to.
I mean, right, so if you look at Lamar, what Lamar basically said is we had an individual application of the statute. Lamar had a billboard. DOT was deciding whether that billboard was permitted or not. It in the context of that proceeding, it announced its interpretation, and Lamar essentially says, well, sorry, you can't avoid the obligation to promulgate a rule simply by announcing your interpretation in the context of a specific case. So I'm quite certain that, I mean, that is how this case started. It was an individual, wasn't even an enforcement action yet, but it was an individual back and forth between DNR and Leather Ridge. You know, an individual case, one-on-one, facts on the ground, and we get this argument. So I don't know where that leaves us. I mean, where that leaves us is, again, I think 227.10 sub 1 needs to be construed quite narrowly. And, again, the authorities for doing that are the guidance document statutes, which are the later enacted statutes, mind you. I mean, those are the legislature's most recent pronouncement on this topic. 227.10 sub 1's predecessor dates back, I think, to 1953. And it's worth noting, at that time, the rulemaking procedures were extraordinarily streamlined compared to what they are now. Justice Hagedorn, I think you put it very memorably, a canoe traversing the ocean is what it's like now. Back then, maybe you didn't even have to hold a hearing, and you certainly didn't have to send it to the legislature for their approval. You could just basically publish it. And so in that era, you know, perhaps it made more sense, but now it does not.
I just have one preliminary question just to get everyone on the same page. Is it spill singular or spills plural?
There is some debate about
that. We should all just be on the same page.
There's some debate about that.
Okay. All right. I guess we'll have to break the tie. I have a few questions here regarding the notice requirement that you talked to Justice Rebecca Bradley about. And what I want to do is just ask you to respond to some of the writings in your friend's briefs, where I think one actually has to do with vagueness, but I think that falls under the rubric of notice, whether or not people whether or not people realize that this is something that is being regulated. The first is on page 8 of Leatherich's brief, and it says, and according to Leatherich on page 8 of their brief, they say simply owning property can subject one to spills law liability. According to they also say something about also can buying a gallon of milk, which of course in Wisconsin would make everyone very, very nervous. So I just want to get your thoughts on whether or not someone owning property, simply owning property, or someone buying a gallon of milk is going to subject them to the spills law.
Only if they spill it, Justice Grofsky.
Well, what'd you say? Right.
Only
so
if they spill it.
I'll take that in two steps.
If they spills the property?
First on the possessor point, this court resolved that question long ago in Mothi. That was the first time this court considered a spill law question. It was exactly that one, is when do simply possessors of the land potentially incur spills law liability? And this court took a very broad view of the spills law and said, if essentially possessors of a hazardous substance, because it's still being discharged, you know, the discharge is not the initial dumping alone, it's also the propagation of the contamination once it's in the environment and the soil. That's a discharge, and the possessor of the property incurs liability. That's what Mothi says. The next case, Chrysler, I think emphasizes a key point here, which is, again, that the legislature chose to create a strict liability regime here. And the legislature had a choice when it considered how to address harmful discharges. One, it can socialize the losses, have taxpayers pay for cleanup costs. Alternatively, it can impose that liability on the dischargers and the property owners, you know, often the people who actually profited off the activity that led to the discharges. And the legislature made the latter decision to place the liability on the possessors and the owners and the dischargers rather than socialize the losses, and to do that through a strict liability regime that does not require knowledge. And that's a conscious choice. As for milk, the gallon of milk, of course a gallon of milk does not qualify. Now what I will say is if there is any question in a regulated party's mind, you can simply call DNR, and DNR will either say, no, we don't think it's a hazardous substance discharge, and you're done, or it says, yes, I think it is a hazardous substance discharge, in which case you now have two choices. You can start complying with the spills law obligations, or you can say, I disagree. And again, that's back to this force of law question. You have the ability to say, I disagree, and contest DNR's view in an enforcement action. And Leatherich was free to take that course here. Instead, it's taken this one.
But what they are saying in their brief on page 8 is, quote, according to DNR, according to your position, simply owning property can subject one to spills law liability. And my question is that your argument?
That's accurate if there's a spill that qualifies on your property. And again, that is squarely what Mothi held in 1985.
And then they say, and I appreciate where Justice Rebecca Bradley was coming from, but it actually says, and according to the arguments put forth by DNR in this case, so can buying a gallon of milk.
Yeah, I think Justice Rebecca Bradley helpfully articulated why that's wrong. I mean, there needs to be a spill. And not just any spill. I think it's critical. We have to go back to the text of this statute. I disagree that it's an unclear statute. It rests on objective scientific facts. And there has to be, you know, the reason the gallon of milk or the keg of beer hypo just doesn't work is there is just no conceivable argument that that poses a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment.
So that would be...
We have to use a little bit of common sense here.
So that would be your answer if I asked you to respond to page 10 of WMC's brief that says, what if a person spills a beer at a barbecue or drops a jar of pickles on the way out of the grocery store?
Same answer.
Counsel, I thought you were done.
I've got some vagueness questions, but if you want to follow up.
You mentioned that it's not vague because we can rely on objective scientific fact. If the pandemic taught us nothing, it's that objective scientific fact does indeed involve, and sometimes in a short period of time.
Science certainly evolves. I will return to what I said earlier, which is there has never been a hint of a dispute from the other side that this discharge is not actually hazardous. There is, say what you will about COVID, there is no dispute in the scientific community that PFAS discharges at very, very, very small levels pose a serious threat to human health. And Justice Krosky, I don't know, this may anticipate some of your vagueness questions. It's also important to recognize this is not a due process vagueness claim. They very well could have teed this up as one. They declined to. And I don't think there's any rulemaking doctrine that I've seen that says, well, rulemaking is required when it might be nice to have additional notice. I mean, that's not how the rulemaking doctrine has arisen. Again, there's no vagueness challenge, and I think the reason is they know it would have lost. I mean, the standard for facial invalidation of a statute on vagueness grounds is very high, especially for a civil regulatory statute, and especially when the discharge at issue clearly falls within the four corners of the statute. I mean, that is black-letter law that if you fall within the four corners of a statute that you say is vague, you can't make that challenge because the statute applies to you clearly. That's very clear in the criminal context, also applies in the civil context. So this sort of 11th hour vagueness claim that we've seen, I just don't think gets them anywhere.
So just to maybe put a finer point on that, I just want to point to page 19 of WMC's. They characterize your arguments as this. A few examples highlight these vagueness concerns. If a person sprays PFAS containing cooking spray on his outdoor grill, must he report that discharge to DNR? What if a person washes a nonstick pan in his kitchen sink? Or if he puts a PFAS-containing food wrapper into a garbage can at the park? Under DNR's apparent view of the law, all these discharges must be reported to DNR. Is that true?
I don't think so. I mean, again, it depends on the facts and circumstances. That is how the legislature crafted the spills law. It crafted the spills law using spill law, using a broad standard. I think these hypotheticals, a wrapper, there's just, again, there's no conceivable universe in which that poses a substantial threat to human health. And again, I understand that the response was not entirely satisfying for Justice Rebecca Bradley, but you can, DNR is there to help people comply with the statute. That's how this has worked for 50 years. And the legislature knows that's how this has worked for 50 years. It saw Mothy, it saw Chrysler outboard. It saw that this is a strict liability regime that does land even on the possessors of land, that is those who did not cause the original discharge. Legislature is well aware of these two seminal decisions of this court and has never amended the spills law either to require rulemaking, which many, many other provisions in Chapter 292 require, nor has it amended the spills law to impose a mens rea requirement, which other environmental statutes have. Some statutes require knowing conduct. You know, the person liable has to understand that what it's doing subjects it to liability. Again, Chrysler outboard was very clear on this point. This is exactly the argument that Chrysler made, and Chrysler outboard said, I didn't know that this was happening, you know, 10 years later. And the court said, well, that's the choice the legislature made with strict liability. Because again, when we're dealing with environmental spills, there's no free lunch. Someone's got to pay for it. It's either the taxpayers or it's the people who discharge or possess the land on which the discharge occurs. That's the choice. Someone's got to do it, and the legislature made the choice, and I think that choice needs to be respected.
Chief, I just have one more question, please.
Okay.
Thank you. This has to do with the effect of law that you haven't had a chance to talk about yet. And the WMC brief says that DNR's policy of regulating emerging contaminants as hazardous substances has the effect of law because, and then they list four reasons, right? The statement was within DNR's expertise. DNR had the power to enforce it. DNR used mandatory language, and such enforcement carries potential civil penalties. I want to give you a chance to respond to their effective law argument, and then I'm done, Chief. Thank you.
So I have two things to say on the effective law
briefly.
Argument. Very quickly.
Brief.
One, the proposition that whether an interpretation has the effect of law is, they quote, a question of degree. What, if you look at Berry Labs, where that quote came from, I encourage you to read Berry Labs. It's a very good discussion of this. And it basically says, when an agency is acting within the realm of his expertise, what it says about the law is more likely to have the effect of law. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. Tetra Tech, we don't defer to agencies anymore. And so this proposition that interpretations can sometimes have the effect of law rested on an age that's no longer with us, when courts would defer to agency interpretations. And this goes back to my core point, which is when the agency simply conveys its view about the law, and Justice Kelly put it this way in SAU, I think it was very apt, communications about the law are not the law itself. And so that's our core position here about why a DNR statements do not represent the law, because they got to prove it in an enforcement action if they're challenged, and courts will review that issue de novo. There's no deference.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. There were a few extra minutes there. We've kept track of that, so if the other side needs a few extra minutes, we'll accommodate.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. As an initial matter, WMC and I intend to divide our argument by subject matter. So I intend to address the rulemaking requirement for hazardous substance regulation, and he intends to address the VPLE program and the constitutional arguments. But first, I think it's important for us to understand how we got here today. Sitting behind me is Ms. Joanne Cantor. She is the owner of Leatherich. And Ms. Cantor has spent 6 years and several hundred thousand dollars just trying to decipher what the law requires of her. She's been attempting to remediate the Leatherich property, and more than once over those 6 years, DNR has changed the rules without notice, unilaterally. And each time that moves her further from completing that Leatherich remediation. And in the time since that remediation began, this court unanimously reaffirmed in Lamar that it's a fundamental principle of our legal system that regulated parties have fair notice of what is forbidden or required of them. And that's especially important here, where this is a self-implementing program, and it applies to every single business, landowner, individual, even visitors of our state. And that's why rulemaking is required here.
Attorney Burr, can you give me an example of a substance that would be covered by the spill or spills law without any rules?
Certainly. The spills law, it's a very complex set of rules, and it references multiple other state and federal environmental regulations. So one example we gave in our brief was in 292.11 sub 12b, where the spills law applies to any discharges regulated under the state and federal Emergency Protection and Community Right to Know Act, which is EPCRA. EPCRA then references a whole suite of federal regulations.
Okay, so only the ones that are in other regulations is what your position is?
Correct. There are also other places in DNR statutes where they have expressly provided a list of substances that, for example, are toxic in a certain medium and at a certain level. And we referenced, I think, 215 as well as 661, NR 215 and NR 661.
So, for example, is arsenic one of those? Is cyanide one of those?
Those substances are already determined toxic by DNR in those other rules.
So your position to us is that only if some other rule or the DNR were to list it as a toxic substance would it be something that would be covered by the spills law?
That's correct. And that goes to the requirement for fair notice.
Are you done?
Maybe. Go ahead.
The spills law itself has been around for about 50 years, right?
Correct.
And there's nothing new about this law being applied to emerging contaminants like PFAS, right?
I think the application to emerging contaminants of this type and of a category this broad is new.
I think we can all agree that according to the record that we have, PFAS don't break down in the environment, right? They remain for long periods in our air and our water.
Well, Your Honor, there are, as DNR counts, at least 9,000 PFAS compounds, and I don't think the record supports that that's the case for every single one of them. I don't think science has developed to that point.
The record that is before us, though, shows us that there are PFAS compounds that pose significant dangers to human health, right?
I think there are certain substances that may, but again, the science, we have disputed this issue despite how my friend has portrayed it. There is scientific dispute over what impact these, even the most studied of PFAS substances have. And you can see that in the difference between the federal regulations, which regulate discharges at 1 pound per day, and what we're talking about here, which is parts per trillion, infinitesimally small amounts. So I think there's just disagreement.
Some of the risks that science have found regarding PFAS include increased risks of thyroid disease, increased risks of cancer, negative effects on the endocrine system, negative effects on the reproductive system, increased cholesterol, decreased fertility in women, and lower infant birth weights. Isn't that correct?
I will take your word in the word in the record.
I'm reading what has been submitted in this case, and that is in the record of this case.
Yes, Your Honor, but we again, this is not about any particular substance. I want to make sure that's clear. This dispute is not about a particular PFAS substance.
Counsel, I want to ask you a little
bit
about...
Can I just follow? I just have a couple more.
You still going ahead?
Yeah. I didn't find an instance in your brief where you, in fact, disagreed that PFAS is a hazardous substance. Do you disagree with that?
We disagree that PFAS as a category is called a hazardous substance because the science on 9,000 compounds plus has not developed. And we've footnoted that in... I'm sorry, I don't have the specific site, but we absolutely raised that issue in our brief.
If we find in your favor the way that you're asking us to, then responsible parties would not have to report the discharge of PFAS. Is that right?
Until the rules are promulgated, so we have a clear understanding of at what level it needs to be reported.
And responsible parties would not have to identify PFAS, would they?
Again, we're talking about 9,000 compounds here. I'm not sure which ones you're asking about.
And responsible parties would not have to investigate contaminated sites, would they?
I think the spills law will still apply to certain contaminated sites that are regulated.
We're talking about PFAS here.
There are instances where the spills law will apply to discharges of PFAS based on that incorporation of the federal regulatory requirements.
Okay. Under your interpretation of the spills law, could the spills law be implemented in a way that would make a responsible party have to investigate sites contaminated with PFAS?
Yes. If the discharge is at a certain level, that it subjects that site to EPCRA requirements, federal EPCRA requirements, then it can be regulated under the spills law.
I have a follow-up question to something Justice Krofsky was asking you. I think that, and perhaps that can be addressed in rebuttal as well, but the DNR has estimated that there are 9,000 individual PFAS compounds and thousands of PFAS mixtures, but DNR provided a list of about 18 that they considered hazardous. So when we're talking about this category, and I think you alluded to this, not all PFAS are hazardous. And is that part of your argument that your client is unable to determine which they are, which ones are hazardous because DNR won't tell her and she's left guessing at the risk of spending a lot of money and incurring a lot of fines? And so when I think your friend on the other side said, we're from the government and we're here to help you, basically, Where's the help? Is that your argument?
That's part of it. And I think it's not just which substances, but at what level. And I think this idea that you can call the DNR and ask, is this a hazardous substance discharge, yes or no, is a bit of a fallacy. That's not how it works. You have to report the discharge. And when you do, DNR accepts your assertion that this is a hazardous substance discharge, and they open a remediation case, and it becomes a data point. Now, for a fee, you can then ask DNR, hey, is there any remediation I have to do? And they might say no, but they don't unilaterally tell you this isn't a hazardous substance discharge, and you don't have to report it in the future.
It sounds like your beef is with the statute then, Attorney Brewer. With the spills law itself, which is the one that puts the obligation on the person, right? Isn't that your complaint?
I think our issue here is with the changing interpretation of that statute as applied.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you say that these documents somehow are the force of law, but isn't it true that you can go into court and challenge the enforcement action and those? The DNR is not going to be pointing to the website. They're not going to be pointing to the letter they sent you. They're going to point to the statute, the one that says that you have the obligation to clean it up if it's hazardous.
Perhaps in the context of an enforcement action, but I think it's important to understand there is a lot more that DNR can do based on their own interpretation. They can take specific direct action without ever going to an enforcement action. They can require preventative measures. They can come onto your property and investigate and remediate a discharge based on their interpretation without ever going to a court.
Right, but it's the court that determines everything is based on hazardous substance defined in the law. It has nothing to do with the claim you're making, and I get that you're making a larger claim, but the claim you made below is that this document, this website and this letter, have the force of law.
Correct.
Let's take those out of the equation. Can't DNR still do all those things you're talking about and say PFAS are hazardous substances?
I'm not certain I understand. I mean, I think PFAS are not within the obvious meaning of this definition. One, certainly not all 9,000 of them, and certainly not at any level. And so the public
is
not.
Those aren't the things that DNR is going to point to when they tell you to remediate or when they take you to court for an enforcement action. They're going to point to the statute.
But I think if DNR comes onto your property and says, we're going to investigate and remediate on your property based on our interpretation of the spills law, our interpretation of hazardous substance, then that definition, I think aside from that, the ability to bring an enforcement action means that DNR has the force of law.
Anything DNR does is a force of law because they have an ability to bring an enforcement action?
I think Josen Manufacturing and at least one other case on rulemaking actually mentions that it is the ability to bring an enforcement action that means their interpretation has the force of law.
So agencies can't do anything under your interpretation?
I don't think that's our position. Our position is that if the agency is interpreting this in a manner that is not within the obvious meaning of this definition. The definition is very vague. It's very broad. It has layers of ambiguity. Then they have to put the public on notice. This is about putting the regulated community on notice.
I want to ask about your ambiguity argument. You're not asking us to overturn SEIU, correct?
I think SEIU is distinguishable here because the force of law issue is what distinguishes the guidance document from a rule, and SEIU applies to guidance documents.
Okay, but you talk about ambiguity, and you say that 227.10 sub 1 requires rulemaking for agencies to interpret and implement ambiguous statutes. When has this court ever read 227.10 sub 1 to require rulemaking in that situation?
Your Honor, I think certainly in Lamar, the interpretation of an ambiguous statute in a new way for the first time requires rulemaking.
No, that's not what Lamar said. Lamar wasn't the interpretation of a statute for the first time, was it? Lamar was a 180-degree interpretation of a statute for not the first time.
I think the same could be said when it's a new interpretation that has not been taken before. And our position is that DNR has not previously regulated a broad category of emerging contaminants like it does here. That is a new interpretation. It is a changed interpretation, and it requires rulemaking so that the regulated community can know what's expected of it.
It seems to me, you know, at the end of your brief, you say that the DNR wants it both ways. But when I read that, I thought perhaps you might be projecting just a bit, because on the one hand, you're suing DNR because they communicated with your client about the spills law and PFAS. And then in your briefing, you complain that, quote, DNR provided no guidance to Ms. Cantor regarding which of the thousands of PFAS compounds were considered hazardous substances and at what concentration those substances would be considered an exceedance. I mean, how is DNR supposed to communicate with your client when communicating with your client leads to you suing them? They were communicating with your client about these very issues.
They should communicate with my client in the same way they communicate with the entire regulated community by rulemaking, so that there is a clear standard that can be applied in forward applications where folks understand when they have an obligation to report a discharge to the DNR.
Justice Protosevich.
Thank you, Chief. I've got a statutory construction question for you. The DNR noted that there were 18 places in Chapter 292 where the legislature directs the DNR to promulgate rules. Yet the legislature omitted that directive with respect to hazardous substances. To me, that sounds like or seems like textual evidence that the DNR did not want to require rulemaking on hazardous substances. Can you tell me what your response is to that?
Sure. I see my time is up. May I respond?
And Justice Hagedorn has one for you, too. We've got a lineup going ahead.
Sure. I think DNR cited no case that explicitly requires such a rulemaking demand in the statute at issue. And I think even accepting DNR's argument that the legislature did not intend to require rulemaking when they pass the spills law, which we disagree with, but let's say we accept that, that's been superseded by the changes to 227 that more broadly require rulemaking in instances like this. So the lack of that sort of demand to DNR to undertake rulemaking here, I think is entirely meaningless in light of Chapter 227.
I wanted to just make sure I understand the nature of your argument. You started with talking about sort of fair notice as kind of the foundation, and if there's not fair notice about what chemicals might be regulated, that, you know, rulemaking, I guess, is the prescribed remedy for that. Is it, if there was a substance that clearly met the statutory definition of hazardous, say you just conceded, you agreed that for sure this would meet that definition, I think your position, correct me if I'm wrong, is still that that can't be regulated at this point until a rule is adopted about that. Is that correct?
Sort of. I mean, I think if we're at that position, there is a very, very good chance that that substance will already be regulated under one of the
take
programs.
Take my hypothetical, which, you know, hypothetical is what it is. But let's assume it's not already prescribed under any of the other, understand that, you know, there's other things that are listed in federal law, et cetera. So let's assume it's not that. Let's say, but it's something that you and everybody in the world agrees this is a hazardous substance, meets the statutory definition of that, but is not specifically enumerated anywhere. Like, is your position that the DNR cannot take action on that until rulemaking is accomplished?
Yes, but I think rulemaking is going to be a very easy endeavor in that case. And
Sure. I understand. I'm just trying to understand that.
Yeah.
Don't think rulemaking is an easy endeavor in any case.
Having
walked
intent.
That walk, I don't think so.
And is that, in the reason, it's not Your argument isn't really a fair notice argument, is it? I thought your argument was more because it was an interpretation. So I was a little struck by your argument. I'm just trying to understand the legal ground. I mean, there is no principle that I'm aware of in the law that if the legislature passes a broad, somewhat vaguely worded statute, but specific enough to do something, that they can't act until they pass, until they have a rule. I'm unaware of any principle of law that makes that a general rule that always applies. If there is, please enlighten me, but I'm unaware of it. Is your argument that it just meets the definition of a rule because of 227.10 or because of some fair notice kind of general argument along those lines?
I mean, I think we make a couple arguments, and three specifically, and the 227.10 is one of them. And the fact that their general application, forward-looking, also means that this meets the definition of 227.0113 of a rule. And then we also argue that the requirement that discharges be reported at a detectable level it violates 227.10.2M. So I think all three of those arguments kind of go hand in hand.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. I think it's still morning. And may it please the court. Lucas Weber, appearing on behalf of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Incorporated, the other plaintiff and respondent in this matter. I'd like to begin by talking, briefly just following up on Justice Protasiewicz's question with regard to where that rulemaking requirement is. That rulemaking requirement is in 227. It exists in both 227.10 sub 1 as well as in the definition of a rule in 227.0113. The legislature doesn't always impose a rulemaking requirement when they intend for the agency to promulgate rules. We see that even within Chapter 292. Under Chapter 292.31, subsection 1, the DNR is required to promulgate a database of all hazardous substance locations. The legislature recognized that that might be a rule. They then exempted them from rulemaking explicitly. They said in subdivision 4 there that notwithstanding sections 227.0113 and notwithstanding sections 227.10 sub 1, that database is not a rule. So I think the legislature has recognized that those two sections of the statutes do apply in places where they haven't directed an agency to promulgate rules. Certainly the legislature has commanded that agencies shall promulgate rules in particular cases, but they haven't always required it. And I think that's helpful background here as we go on to the other issue that's in this case, and that's the department's interim decision as it relates to their administration of the Voluntary Party Liability Exemption Program, or the VPLE program.
Counsel, before you get to that, your
yes.
comments addressed in part now 227.10. Do you agree with your opposing counsel's comment that the posture of your argument has changed in this case from that advanced in the Court of Appeals by making a more, what he suggests, aggressive push on 227.10 sub 1?
Your Honor, I think we've always argued throughout this case that it requires rulemaking. And the source of that requirement comes from 227.10, but it also comes from the definition of a rule.
Okay. My question is, do you agree with his assertion that your position has changed from the Court of Appeals, where you were advancing arguments vis-a-vis the website and the letter, among others, that now your emphasis here is an aggressive attack under 227.10? Do you agree with his assertion that there's a change?
Well, no, Your Honor, and I think we're still relying on those letters and the website as evidence of the department's policy that they've adopted here. So the policy is not the letter itself. The policy is the department has a policy that's evidenced by the letter, but it's the policy the department has adopted that was challenged in this action.
It wasn't clear to me ultimately what the response was, so let me ask you this question. Do you agree with your opposing counsel's assertion that there is no dispute that PFAS satisfies the definition of hazardous material?
No, I don't agree with that, but I think the appropriate way for the agency to make that determination is to promulgate it as a rule. And to my colleague's point that if it's something that is almost, you know, if it's much easier, if everyone agrees, if it's a standard that very clearly will apply here, then that's certainly where the standard should be drawn in the statute. I would also say that the agency doesn't need to promulgate and list every single substance it can. It could also do what federal law has done and list objective criteria for what could meet the statute. That's another way that they could comply with the requirements under 292. The VPLE interim decision, which is the other issue in this case, relates to the state's brownfield redevelopment program. So the VPLE program allows sites to be remediated, redeveloped, brought back into the stream of commerce. It's a major benefit to the state, local communities, and the public at large. Typically, when there's a discharge of a hazardous substance, that hazardous substance is remediated. Once it's remediated to the department's satisfaction, they issue a case closure letter and everyone moves on. What the VPLE program does is it goes above and beyond that. The VPLE program is a voluntary program that parties can apply to. Once they're in the program, once they've been accepted by the department, they conduct a much broader investigation. They look for any possible hazardous substance discharges that they were not previously aware of. They remediate all of those substances, and then the department issues what's called a certificate of completion.
Which has the benefit to the property owner, right? So
a
in addition to the other people you listed, it has a significant advantage to them, correct?
Yes, a significant benefit to the property owner. And the benefit is that it gets a clean bill of health. The property owner has remediated that site, the department's satisfaction. Once the department is satisfied, they say, hey, we don't believe there are any hazardous substances on the site. It then shifts liability from that property owner to the state if a legacy discharge is found later on the site. Of course, future discharges of hazardous substances are not covered by that. The interim decision policy upended the VPLE program. The interim decision was made to completely eliminate the issuance of those general certificates of completion. Fortunately, for landowners who want to rely on the VPLE program, that interim decision is unlawful. And it's unlawful because it meets the definition of a rule under 227.01.13. This court in Citizens for Sensible Zoning has broken down the definition of a rule in 227.01.13 into a five-part test. A rule is a regulation, standard, statement of policy, or general order of general application, having the effect of law issued by an agency to implement, interpret, or make specific legislation that is enforced or administered by that agency. Where an agency action meets that five-part test, it is a rule, and it is required to be promulgated under Chapter 227. Here, the interim decision, as I said, meets that definition of a rule. First, it's a regulation, standard, statement of policy, or general order. It announces the department's policy to all VPLE program participants, indeed to all Wisconsinites, that it was not going to do something in particular, it was not going to issue.
Do you have a right to participate in the VPLE?
It's a voluntary program that you have to apply for.
Right, so you have no real legal interest in it, right? I mean, the department could just decide that they're not going to grant any of these.
Yes, they've made a general policy that they're not going to grant any of them. That's correct. And that general policy is a rule that they would have had to promulgate because it governs their enforcement and administration of that.
No, I'm saying in theory they don't have to give it to anybody. You don't have a right to come to court and say I'm entitled to a VPLE.
Correct. Correct. They do not. But once the department makes a general policy that they're going to apply to everybody who applies in that program, with the VPLE program, the department has broad discretion. They have discretion on how to run the program, how it operates. But once the department makes a uniform policy as to how they're going to exercise that discretion that they're going to apply to everyone, that's a rule. It's a general policy of general application. It has the force of law. It was issued by an agency to make specific legislation that's enforced or administered by the agency. That's why the interim decision meets the definition of a rule. It was not promulgated as a rule, and it's unlawful. As I said,
I still don't see how you have an interest that could be legally affected. If you have no interest in having it in the first place, how do you have an interest that's legally affected?
Well, our members rely greatly on the VPLE program. It's a tremendous
because
program.
Because it's a tremendous program that helps you, but you have no right to it.
It certainly helps us, and it's certainly available to our members. Generally, it was, anyways, prior to the interim decision. The interim decision took the value away from that program. They couldn't apply for it. Why would they? There was no benefit to them. And the reason that there was no benefit to them, the benefit that was available potentially to them, was taken away by the department's rule. As I was saying, it's generally applicable. To be generally applicable, it need not apply to all persons within the state. It just has to apply to a class that people could be added to. Certainly here it applies to all VPLE program participants, of which, as I said, anybody could apply to join. And third, and there's been a lot of discussion here on the force of law, that's the third element of the 227.01.13 test. The interim decision certainly here has the force of law. Case law indicates that an agency action has the effect of law for two reasons, which are applicable here, when licensure can be denied or when the interest of individuals in a class can be legally affected through an action. And that's exactly what the interim decision here
is. So we're back to that. Interests of individuals can be affected. What interest do your clients have in participating in the VPLE law?
Well, generally, they could apply for the program.
They can apply, and they can be rejected. So what's their interest? They don't have a right under the statute to have it, right?
No, but they have the right to apply to the program and for the program to exist, Your
Honor. So they have the right to apply, so that's what you're saying the interest is?
Yeah, and once the decision is made by the department that they're going to, again, universally apply that policy to all applicants to the program, which they did here, the agency has adopted a policy. They've adopted a rule. Once an agency adopts a policy, they're engaging in lawmaking. That's a legislative function. They have to exercise that policy according to the confines of Chapter 227. If an agency adopts an unlawful rule, it has unlawfully usurped the power of the legislature, and our Constitution doesn't allow that.
Counsel, could you respond to just the argument of your opposing counsel that, just going back to the force of law question,
yeah.
I understand when, you know, there's lots of statutes that give the executive branch discretion to do A, B, or C, and that happens all the time. And so, you know, Governor Walker might have done A, and then Governor Evers might do B, more often or less often, and maybe they say it, maybe they don't, but those are generally understood in the law to be within the prerogative of the executive and exercising the discretion given to them, if that's what the statute does. So the argument you're opposing counsel is that it's not a force of law question. It's just how you exercise the discretion that you're already given by the law. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I would respond to that by saying the department here is characterizing all of these actions as guidance documents that don't have the force of law. I think the primary difference between a guidance document and a rule is that rules have the force of law, guidance documents do not. So certainly when the executive is administering a statute that's plain and clear, tells the executive exactly what they need to do, the executive is going to take those actions, and there's no adoption of a statement of policy, or there's no adoption of an interpretation of the statute that's needed here. They just take the steps that they're commanded. Once the executive, though, goes a step further, as here, I think the hazardous substance definition is a perfect example of this. It's a broad, open-ended definition of the statute that clearly contemplates that at some point uncertain in the future, yet unknown substances may become regulated by that statute. The problem is nobody knows when that point uncertain is known. The department says, oh, the science has evolved to the point that it is. But how does everybody know? Because for 50 years, it's been operated successfully, as they said. But during those 50 years, PFAS were discharged, and nobody thought they were hazardous substances. So at what point do people know, or are they supposed to know, that those substances become hazardous? And the answer is that once the department makes that determination, they have to promulgate that as a rule. And that gives the fair notice to the regulated community, but it also is their constitutional duty when they're exercising their policymaking power.
So are you saying this? Are you making that some kind of due process claim here? That they had a duty to fair notice? I mean, that seems to me you didn't make that argument.
In our brief, Your Honor, we argued our understanding of how the statute works, and we responded to their argument by saying that, you know, if the statute doesn't work this way and it allows the department to regulate on an ad hoc basis without promulgating rules so that nobody knows what the law is as they're doing that, then that would raise constitutional concerns, due process concerns. Yes.
I thought your argument
pretty high burden.
I heard you adopting more of the ambiguity argument of Leatherich.
Yeah.
You know what I'm going to ask.
I think the it goes hand in hand. Those two arguments are related, Your Honor. I think the milk example is a great example here. The department has said that if a tanker truck of milk spills, it is certainly a hazardous substance discharge. But today he said if you drop a gallon of milk, it's not a hazardous substance discharge. So somewhere in the middle there, it becomes a hazardous substance discharge. But when? Nobody knows.
Well, how would they ever function? Each individual case is going to be different. Every fact situation is different. What if they spill 5 gallons? What if they spill 10? What if they spill 20? You
what
want
if it's
DNR?
Soy milk?
What about soy
exactly,
milk?
Yeah.
What about almond milk? What about oat milk? That's
it's
my
not
favorite.
Milk.
Your Honor,
that's a whole other debate.
Exactly,
but my point
Honor.
Is these
exactly.
are fact-specific situations. Isn't that exactly why we have enforcement actions? Isn't that exactly why we have the ability to interpret that the executive has to be able to apply the law? That's called applying the law to the facts.
Yeah, Your Honor, exactly. And I think that, to your point, it does create a significant amount of uncertainty. I mean, where do we draw the line? If a milk delivery truck has a hand truck full of milk crates and they bring it in and spill it, does that rise to the level of
well,
hazard?
Right,
nobody
but what
knows
you're arguing to us and what you're Attorney Brewer's arguing to us is that somehow DNR has to set all this out in the statute or in the rule before they could possibly act. And that is insane. That
yeah.
means that you can spill the 20 gallons because by the time you make a rule about it, heck, it'll already have done whatever damage it did.
Yeah, and Your Honor, that's what the statutes require. That's what 227.10
sub
1 requires.
227 requires
of DNR.
Every single, so we got to see whether it's 1 gallon, 5 gallons, 10 gallons, 20 gallons, and then if it's 25 and we don't have a rule, we can't enforce it. That's what I hear you arguing, and that's what I hear Attorney Brewer.
Your Honor, as I said, I think the department could provide a list of substances. I think they could also promulgate objective – and I'm sorry, my light is on.
Wait, continue.
They could also promulgate a list of objective criteria by which the public could, in each one of those circumstances, affirmatively know if they're violating the hazardous substance statute or not. That's what the federal government does. That's what the DNR could do, but they haven't done it, and they refuse to do so. And we're asking this court to require that they do so. And for these reasons, I would ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals in this case.
Did we miss anyone up here?
Thank you, Chief.
Okay.
Thanks,
Chief.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, in the interest of time, as you approach the podium, I'm going to start asking you a question.
Like nothing less.
Got a hot bench today.
Justice Gallant asked, how is the government supposed to function? The same could be said for the regulated community. How are they supposed to function? The lady behind you was trying to retire, as I understand it, 6 years ago. She's been cooperating with the DNR, and the goalposts keep changing. So there is a way to function, right? And your friend on the other side just alluded to it. This is how federal environmental law and the agencies at the federal level manage it, right? It's not this absurd idea to promulgate very specific rules governing very specific discharges under very specific...
If I may, the federal rules to which she is pointing operate very, very differently. EPCRA sets, and they point this out in their brief, a 1 pound reporting threshold in a 24-hour period. That is a tremendous amount of PFAS to be discharged. It takes, I think, 4 drops in an Olympic-sized pool to exceed recommended drinking standards. So CERCLA and EPCRA, the federal standards to which they point, it's the Superfund site. It's meant to address large facilities, wastewater treatment plants that are pumping out millions of gallons of contaminated material. CERCLA and EPCRA are not meant to do exactly what the spills law is meant to do, which is extend environmental protections to beyond simply huge sort of point dischargers like wastewater treatment plants to cover, again, dry cleaning facilities, which do discharge significant amounts of PFAS. And specifically, and I want to make very clear, we hear this 9,000 PFAS substances. I think that's a red herring. What's very clear here is PFOA and PFOS, Leatherich PFOS discharges were 8 times greater than the standard they proposed. Again, no one has any doubt that these two compounds that were present on Leatherich's property are dangerous. Now, I keep hearing, well, we dispute that. There is nothing in the record whatsoever that contradicts DNR's scientific evaluation that Some of those 9,000 substances, including two of which were found and that are at issue in Leatherich's property, qualify.
Counsel, I wanted to just get to just a quick question about something we talked about quite a bit, and that's the definition of a rule. And with regard to what you call our need to interpret the word interpretation in it narrowly. And I wanted to see if you could offer us a sense of what in your ideal world we would say about that. Like, what would be your statement of the rule or principle that you would ask this court to adopt to manage these and, you know, obviously innumerable complex situations that might arise in the future?
It's a difficult question. I mean, one option the court could take is to say, you know, this would be dodging the question a little bit, but we don't have to decide what exactly is covered by 227.10 sub 1. What we do have to decide here is that when the agency reads a statute, applies it to a set of factual circumstances presented for the first time, that just constitutionally, and again, I heard very little about guidance documents. Their position, I heard nothing about the statute, 227.10, or well, whatever the guidance document definition falls in. I mean, I can't help but read that and think this is exactly what happened here. The agency explains how it intends to administer a statute. So I guess one way you could write it is to say that's what DNR did here. It falls under the guidance document definition, and plainly when an agency does that, it can't be rulemaking because that's what the guidance document statute
says.
Right,
but that doesn't get to their other argument. So what would you have us say about that broader argument?
Well, there's two, right, and I think, well, they do go hand in hand, I think, because the way I read 227.10 sub 1, at some level it has to be the flip side of the definition of a rule. I mean, you can't issue a rule that doesn't have the force of law. I mean, that is a definitional requirement. So it can't be that 227.10 requires you to promulgate something as a rule that itself cannot have the force of law. I mean, it's an interpretation, and it is tested in court, and so that can't be what 227.10 sub 1 requires.
But Lamar did interpret it and say exactly what it requires. I'm looking at paragraph 21. While the first sentence, referring to 227 sub 10 sub 1, requires a rule for each statutory interpretation, the department's position in Lamar would, and I think it's your position here, would allow it to regularly engage in ad hoc interpretations of ambiguous statutes. The argument is the statute's ambiguous here because it does not specify hazardous substances, as the department has conceded here. It is a very broad definition, and intentionally so. In paragraph 23, Lamar goes on to say the plain meaning of 227 sub 10 sub 1 is that it describes only one pathway by which an agency can adopt a new interpretation, not a changed interpretation. And PFAS, as I think you would concede, were not regulated or considered hazardous substances by the DNR until that announcement. The agency must adopt a rule. That's what Lamar says. And I know that Lamar, and I understand it was a changed interpretation, a flip-flop, if you will. We don't have that here, but it is indeed a new interpretation, and I can't get beyond the text that does not speak to a change. It speaks to interpretations made by the agency.
Well, Lamar was, again, perhaps you're not persuaded, but it was very clearly about a change. The entire decision rested on that it was not simply that the statute was ambiguous, that there was a change in the interpretation of the statute. I will say this is not this regulation of PFAS or assertion that PFAS falls under the hazardous substance. It is not a changed interpretation. This happens over and over again. I would direct you to page 17 of our opening brief. This happened in the 70s when people first learned about the harmful nature of PCBs, PCEs. I don't have the full word at the tip of my tongue, and then MTBE. But again, these are time and time again, this happens under the spills law. Science evolves. People understand that contaminants that were used as part of ordinary commercial activity pose a threat to human health. This is how the spills law has worked for 50 years. Interpreting 227.10 as broadly as they propose is inconsistent with this court's prior case. Again, I would encourage you to go back to the pre-Lamar cases. Schoolway, I think, is another great example. If you look at Schoolway, involved a change, just like Lamar did. And at the end of the decision, what did the court say? The court said, agency, lo and behold, you made the right decision. You know, the result was not agency, you cannot act. This was about whether DOT could grant certain licenses to bus and charter bus companies. And Schoolway said, well, DOT, you flip-flopped, but nevertheless, you properly denied this license to this bus company. So it's never been the rule until arguably Lamar that, pardon me, that agencies are barred from acting until they promulgate a rule that contains every single interpretation of the statute, which I just very quickly, the last thing I want to point out here, in terms of practical consequences, 227.139, I would direct your attention to, which requires if a rule is going to have compliance costs of greater than $10 million, the agency cannot promulgate it without a bill passed by the legislature that authorizes the rule. There's no question that rules under the spills law would have that impact. So we're in a situation where not only must the agency promulgate a rule defining hazardous substances, but the legislature would have to pass another bill authorizing that rule. So what do we have? We have a spill law that can't be implemented until another statute is passed amending it.
Justice Ann Welsh Bradley.
An absurd result. Question.
Counsel, in reviewing the dissent from the Court of Appeals, it seemed to me to be a rather methodical presentation of the issues before it. You suggest in your comments that there's a new thrust here that may not be covered by the existing Court of Appeals dissent. How, if at all, would you modify the Court of Appeals dissent?
Well, So what I would say is, again, to this question of what was the focus below, I mean, if you read the majority decision, I don't think 227.10 is even mentioned, sub 1, in the majority decision. The majority decision is solely focused on the statements and whether they qualified under 227.01, sub 13. And so I think, I'm now using my memory, but I don't think the dissent spent much time on 227.10, sub 1.
No, you're correct.
Precisely because that really wasn't the argument below. And so in terms of what you would do to sort of tweak the dissent if that were to be the decision, I'd say on the 227.01 sub 13 question, do these statements qualify? I think the dissent got it absolutely right. I do think, though, to nip this 227.10 argument in the bud, you also have to say something about that statute. Outline in our brief what that should be.
Thank you. Interesting oral arguments. The court will adjourn and reconvene.